Okay, well, I hope you guys all had a good weekend. And the next five lectures I'm planning to give, at least the first two are going to be, I hope, in a little bit more familiar territory for you, because I'm going to be discussing kinetic spin systems. And this is probably one of the central topics in non-equilibrium statistical physics, and it's one of the most active areas and the one where I think the greatest insights have come from in the past half century. So let me just remind you some things that are relevant in terms of building up our understanding of kinetic spin systems. So let's first of all just talk about spin systems. And the archetypical example of a ferromagnetic spin system is the Ising model. And in equilibrium, there's several things that I hope that we all know, which is, first of all, there is no phase transition. For D equals 1. But there is a phase transition for spatial dimension D larger than or equal to 2. One dimension is trivially soluble, and the one-dimensional Ising model was first solved by Ernst Ising in 1926 for his PhD thesis. He was a student of a guy named Wilhelm Lenz, who suggested this problem as his PhD problem. And he solved it, and he found there was no phase transition. And he basically left physics because it was considered a failure. And actually, Ernst Ising has a very colorful history because he was, I guess he was married to a Jewish woman, or he was half Jewish, and somehow he managed to survive the Holocaust and World War II without anything horrible happening to him. And then he came and worked at Peoria College in Illinois. And he lived to be, I think, 99 or something like that. And it was only much later in his life that he realized that he was famous. He had no idea he was famous. But properly speaking, the Ising model should have been called the Lenz-Ising model. Anyways, in the middle 1930s, Rudolf Peierls showed that the Ising model in greater than one dimension did not have a phase transition. And so people thought it was, yes?
We should call it the Ising model?
Well, Ising is, if you're going to be German, this is, yeah. You know, Americans pronounce it Ising, but Germans pronounce it Ising. And so if you go to Germany and say Ising, they'll growl at you. Anyways, so in the mid-30s, Peierls showed that the higher dimensional Ising model did not have a phase transition. And then it was not until 1937 that Kramers and Vanier actually proved mathematically that Peierls was wrong and that, in fact, it had a phase transition. This set off a flurry of activity to try and solve it. In 1944, Lars Onsager solved the two-dimensional Ising model. It's one of the most amazing things in mathematical physics. If any of you have, how many people have read this paper? I highly recommend it. Depending on your mood and your degree of inspiration, you'll either be incredibly depressed, like, how could I ever do what this guy did? Or you could be incredibly inspired at the beauty and the power of this guy. So Ising, the two-dimensional Ising model was solved in 1944 by Onsager. There was a flurry of activity after that to try and generalize three dimensions. That seems to be unsoluble, but if you want to win a guaranteed first-class ticket to Stockholm in December, solve the three-dimensional Ising model, and you will definitely win a Nobel Prize. And then in the 70s came the advent of the renormalization group, which was able to understand critical phenomena in greater than two dimensions. So the point is that here, D equals 2 is solvable. D greater than 2, not solvable exactly. And so from this came the renormalization group methods that allowed us to understand equilibrium properties of spin systems. And so on the basis of what we've learned from the renormalization group, the basic idea here is the notion of universality, that critical exponents do not depend on details of the model, but only depend on some basic parameters. And those two basic parameters are typically, so it's exponents. Your critical points depend on the spatial dimension D, and secondarily on the spatial dimensionality of the order parameter. So this is the space dimension. And this guy is the dimensionality of the order parameter. So for example, the Ising model, or Ising model, which has spin up or spin down, has a one-dimensional degree of freedom, spin degree of freedom. So that would be n equals 1. If I have spins which can lie freely on a plane and rotate freely, that's n equals 2. That's the so-called XY model. And n equals 3, where a spin can lie anywhere on the surface of a sphere, that's the Heisenberg model. And so the universality hypothesis says that the exponents depend on d and n. So here is 100 years of critical phenomena in 2 minutes. What I want to now talk about is what happens in non-equilibrium. So non-equilibrium spin systems. So first point is that in the early days of non-equilibrium statistical physics, what people try to do is say, well, in equilibrium, well, that we sort of understand. Let's look at tiny perturbations away from equilibrium. So the first baby step is small deviations from equilibrium. And one would study, if you perturb the system a little bit away from equilibrium, how would it relax back to equilibrium? And the thing that came from this whole story was the so-called fluctuation dissipation relations. Which basically quantified the fact that if you have a system which is fluctuating in equilibrium, the forces that cause the fluctuation to occur are the same as the forces that if you push a system away from equilibrium, how it relaxes back to equilibrium. And because those two forces are essentially different manifestations of the same underlying cause, the way fluctuations decay and the fluctuation spectrum and the way that deviations from equilibrium dissipate back to equilibrium are the same thing. One has a fundamental relation between fluctuations and dissipation that's called the fluctuation-dissipation relation. So this is another major development in the theory of non-equilibrium spin systems. And this is something which I also would regard as well understood. And now we want to come to the second step, which is where this lecture begins, which is large deviations, or far from equilibrium. And here the situation is much less well understood and much less well quantified. And part of the reason for that is that there is no fundamental formalism with which we can calculate. So for example, in the equilibrium spin system, we have basic notions of equilibrium statistical mechanics. We have the partition function. We have the free energy that we minimize. And once we have the free energy, in some sense, we consider the problem solved. In small deviations from equilibrium, there's this whole powerful fluctuation dissipation formalism that allows us to understand small deviations from equilibrium. Far from equilibrium, there is no fundamental theory. So things have proceeded in an ad hoc fashion. And so you'll see that things are a little bit more seat of the pants than anything else that we've been discussing so far. So ultimately, the major goal that I want to accomplish in this next lecture, well, actually maybe two plus lectures, is encapsulated on page 58 of your notes. So if you have them in front of you, I just wanted you to stare at this cartoon for a while. Because the goal of these two lectures is to try and understand what the heck is going on in this cartoon. You can have mine if you want. OK. So the thing is that far from equilibrium, there is, so we are going to try and understand what happens when to take an Ising system, which is far from equilibrium, and we just ask, how does it evolve when you push a system basically off a cliff and watch it fall into the new equilibrium state? So that's going to be the goal of the next two lectures. OK. So the archetypical situation that I'll mainly be discussing is that you start at infinite temperature. So you imagine at infinite temperature, the ferromagnetic coupling between the spins plays no role. Every spin is randomly oriented, and you suddenly the word is called quench. So what that means, sudden quench, means sudden change of the temperature to T equals zero. And you ask, what happens subsequently? And so that's going to be the main focus of the next two lectures. You start, prepare a system at infinite temperature where each spin is randomly, positively, or negatively oriented. You suddenly quench to zero temperature, where we have a sense that at zero temperature, the system should reach the ground state. But as you see in this cartoon, if I start with a pattern with equal number of black and white space, who's going to win out? It's not obvious. And because the two species, black and white, are kind of pushing each other out of the way, one gets this phenomenon known as coarsening. And so coarsening is what is happening in this cartoon. The pattern is having a larger and larger length scale, which is growing continuously with time. And the basic things we want to understand is, what is the geometry of this coarsening? What is the growth of the characteristic length scale as a function of time? So these are the basic questions that we're going to be interested in this lecture. Okay, so with all of that philosophy, let me now just outline some basic facts, some of which will be explained in the course of this lecture and the next. So the first thing is that there's something that I might call the central dogma of non-equilibrium phenomena, which is that it turns out there's three different types of coarsening processes. Normally, in any kind of a coarsening process, when you start the system at infinite temperature, and you suddenly change the temperature, and you ask, how does the system evolve to that new state? But there is three types of coarsening, the so-called supercritical, critical, and subcritical. And what I mean by supercritical is that I start at T equals infinity, and I suddenly quench to a final temperature, Tf, which is greater than the critical temperature of the system. So at T equals infinity, the system is paramagnetic. There's no net order. At the final temperature, if it's above the critical temperature, the system is still paramagnetic. And so the system stays disordered at all times. And what one finds here typically is that there's a fast relaxation to a disordered final state. And in some sense, we would consider this system dull. The critical state is T equals infinity, and the final temperature is exactly equal to the critical temperature. So at the critical temperature, and I hope that you've already had a lot of, this has been pounded into you by maybe Leo Kadanoff and other people, that at the critical temperature, there's a diverging length scale, and there's all kinds of critical fluctuations going on. And so the final state is very complex, whereas the initial state is simple. Because of the complexity of the final state, it turns out that there's many different types of critical quenching processes. And there's as many different types of critical quenching as there are different types of critical behavior. And so this might be called complex. And I'm not going to say anything more about this case because it's complex. Subcritical is I start at T equals infinity, and I have my final temperature, Tf, which is below the critical temperature. So when you're below the critical temperature, that means that the final state will have a non-zero magnetization. And we want to understand how that final magnetization develops. Now, it turns out that from the universality hypothesis, and again, I'm hoping that you've heard some of this in the lectures of Leo Kadanoff, that if I apply a renormalization group transformation to a system below the critical temperature, and I do a length rescaling, the temperature only decreases. And if I continue rescaling ad infinitum, the final temperature is zero. So all subcritical systems have the same, are effectively in the same universality class as zero temperature. So for that reason, it's easiest to consider the case the final temperature equal to zero rather than non-zero. And in this case, the coarsening behavior is simple. Simple, but yet still very fascinating. And so for the rest of these lectures, I'm going to be almost exclusively talking about zero temperature quenches. So I prepare a system at infinite temperature, and I suddenly cool it to zero temperature, and I want to ask, how does the system evolve? The last thing that I want to mention before I start getting into some real details is there's something known as the dynamic, what is it called here? Dynamic scaling hypothesis. For quenching to t equals 0. So there's three basic observations that come from staring at this cartoon. And so let me just outline what these are, and then we're going to actually see in some detail how to derive some of these facts. So the first point is that there exists a single growing length scale . So a very important fact number one, that if you take this cartoon and stare at it and look at it with different degrees of squinting, all the three pictures should look very similar when you have the right length rescaling. And so there's a characteristic size that measures the size of all these blobs, which is growing continuously with time, but there's only one length scale, there's not multiple length scales. So one number, the characteristic length scale, is enough to characterize this growing pattern. The other point is that, so let's call this growing length scale, this is not a T, this is an L, let's call this growing length scale L, little L of T. Next point is that L of T is found to grow as T to some power Z. So the scaling is algebraic in time, power law. So in all models of coarsening that have been, essentially all models that have been studied, the coarsening has power law dependence on time. And the other feature, finally, is that Z is universal. So in the same way that in static critical phenomena there is universal exponents, similarly here there are universal exponents. And these exponents are actually somewhat more universal than in equilibrium critical phenomena, because it turns out that this Z often is independent of D and N. The only thing that matters in this case depends on conservation law. So this is a new feature of the non-equilibrium critical phenomena. It's very different than equilibrium, is that the exponents, the dynamic, this thing is sometimes called the dynamic critical exponent. And it seems to depend on almost nothing except whether or not, in the course of the dynamics, the order parameter is conserved or not conserved. And I'll have more to say about this distinction as I go along. Yes?
So I thought Z was called the dynamical exponent because when you change your scales. But if it's universal, then...
Well, but no, the thing is that this growth of the... This thing is, you know, first of all, I take a system at infinite temperature, suddenly quench at zero temperature, and I just watch it. And as I watch it, I will measure a length which is growing as a power law in time. So this has nothing to do with doing any kind of renormalization group transformation. This is an observational fact that if you were to simulate the Ising model and measure the patterns that come out from the simulations, you would find a characteristic length scale that grew in this fashion with an exponent which is typically 1/2 for the kinetic Ising model. No, it turns out that, that's right. So it doesn't matter on very many details. So the thing is that if I quenched anywhere below the critical temperature, whether it was the Ising model or whether it was like, you know, a three-state model or whatever, we would still have the same course in the exponent. The only thing that's going to matter, and this will become clear, I think, by next lecture, is what is the nature of the dynamics? If it conserves the order parameter microscopically, you get a different behavior than if you have non-conserved dynamics. And these two terms, what is conserved and non-conserved dynamics, will become clear probably in the next 20 minutes or so. Anything else? OK. So what I'd like to do now, so this, I would say, is the end of the philosophy part of this lecture. And now I want to turn to some explicit models and explicit calculations and give you a sense of how we understand some of these relatively vaguely defined terms. And so what I want to spend basically almost the rest of the this lecture on is the so-called Ising-Glauber model. And this is nothing more than the Ising model, which has been endowed with a very specific type of dynamics that was invented by Roy Glauber in 1961. And here again, there's a very amusing story that comes with this, because Roy J. Glauber wrote a very beautiful paper, I guess it was 1963, in Journal of Mathematical Physics, which I highly recommend that you read. And he developed this non-equilibrium theory of the Ising model. But Roy Glauber is actually an atomic physicist, and so he worked on this for a while and just left it and forgot about it. And he worked in atomic physics for many years. He was a professor at Harvard, and then he became, and apparently, you know, I don't want to make this, like, since I'm being taped on this, I don't want to make such a big deal of it, but apparently his reputation as a teacher was not the highest. And so, you know, he became quite old, he didn't want to retire, but they put him in a lousier office, and they kept sort of trying to push him out the door, and, you know, he kept wanting to stay for whatever reason. And so anyways, you may or may not remember that Roy Glauber won part of the Nobel Prize about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. And the next day, oh, Professor Glauber, wouldn't you like a nicer office, Professor Glauber? And, you know, so all of a sudden he got the last laugh because he won the Nobel Prize. Anyways, I had the pleasure of sitting beside him at some, you know, fancy dinner for some other event. And I talked to him and I said, you know, I work on non-equilibrium Ising models and your model is so helpful. And he said, what model? And he had no idea that he was famous in this field, because he didn't work in this field. He did something really great, and he lost interest in it or moved to different things. And he didn't realize that, just like Ernst Ising was famous in his field, that Glauber was very famous in his field, because he did, you know, he turned to other things. Anyways, it's kind of an amusing story. And apparently, the other thing is that they have the annual Ig Nobel Prizes. And apparently what Roy Glauber does is he sweeps the floor. Yeah, he likes sweeping the floor, and people like toss trash on the stage. Okay, so anyways, the Ising-Glauber model. So I'm going to present to you, like, what is the Ising-Glauber model in the course of the ensuing discussion. But the first thing is we need to think about, how do we endow? So here's the basic question. How to endow the Ising model with the dynamics. This is a fundamental question in non-equilibrium statistical physics. And here again is where one is stuck with a situation where there's no fundamental principle. So let's first of all think about equilibrium stat mech. In equilibrium stat mech, we have the partition function. It says, what is the probability that you will find a system in a particular state? But then what? Once you found that the probability of a system is in a particular state, you can compute the partition function, you can compute averages over this probability distribution, and get all of thermodynamics. But what are the temperature changes? What happens then? You know, so if I imagine that there's a Boltzmann distribution, that some low-lying states are highly occupied and high energy states have a weak occupation, and I change the energy levels, how can the system rearrange itself? There is no mechanism within the framework of equilibrium statistical physics to go from one state to another state. You just prescribe the probability of being in that state, and there's no notion of making transitions between that state. So we need to figure out a way to endow the Ising model with a dynamics that allows us to make a transition between states. And here is where, because there's no principles involved anymore, the rule is ad hoc. One just invents a rule to make transition between the states. And the basic idea to try and make a rule that's sensible is that you want to ensure that the rule will permit you to get to the correct equilibrium state. So there's something called the detailed balance principle. Which is the way that one constructs rules that allows you to go from one state to another state and have a non-equilibrium spin system. So the thing about the detailed balance principle is that its principle is maybe much too strong and much too fancy word to describe it. You might call it the detailed balance guess. I mean, that's really what it is. It's just a guess of how you might construct the rates in order to go to the correct equilibrium state. So let's see, what do I want? Yeah, so let's, let me not state what the detailed balance principle is here, because I'll show by construction how to make it, and then hopefully it's going to be clear what the detailed balance principle is. So the thing is that how do we describe an Ising system in non-equilibrium? The way that we might describe it is that we would have a state vector. Let me sort of note an S with curly brackets. And what S refers to is the state of every spin in the system, S1, S2, dot, 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 all the way up to Sn. Each one of these S's can be equal to plus or minus 1. So the state space of the system has 2 to the n possible points in it. So there's 2 to the n possible states. So let me represent the state space abstractly like this. Here's a point in state space. So this refers to a particular point with the value s. And then here's another point in state space. There's all kinds of point in state spaces in state space. And so in equilibrium statistical mechanics, if here is a point s, the probability that the system is in the state will be equal to e to the minus beta, the Hamiltonian associated with that spin state. So in equilibrium, each one of these points is isolated from everybody else, and there's just a certain probability of being here. And in non-equilibrium statistical physics, what we say is that we are going to invent some dynamics that allows us to make transitions between the various states. And there may be transitions out, transitions in, there's transitions both. In fact, typically transitions go in both directions, so we're going to connect some of these points in some way by some transition rate. And from this, we can then make a non-equilibrium process. Now, so let me call P of curly bracket S T. So this is the probability of being in some point in state space. At time t. So what we basically have is that in this abstract state space, we are going to try now invent a random walk-like rule that says that if I'm at some point in state space, there's some probability of making a transition here, for example, or here, or maybe over here. And I want to calculate what are the rates such that I will be guaranteed to go to the correct equilibrium state. And that's essentially what underlies the detailed balance principle. So let me write down now a formal equation for how this probability evolves with time. So there's something, again, called the master equation. And so hopefully now the term master equation doesn't seem so intimidating, because you've seen it in other contexts previously. And you're going to see it in other more contexts during this week. But let me now write down a master equation for the evolution of this probability distribution. So I'm going to write dp of curly s t dt. How can this change with time? So for example, if I'm at this point in state space, how can the probability of being at this point in state space change with time? Either I hop into the state, thereby increasing p, or I hop out of that state, thereby decreasing it. So those two terms, the gain term and the loss term, appear generically in any kind of a master equation. So let's now write down generically a master equation that describes this process. So I guess what I would say is that there is a summation over all neighboring states that are connected to S where I make a transition in and thereby increase the probability. So there'll be something that I'll write as W, S prime going to S, P, S prime time T. So this will be the gain term. And this summation should be over all points S prime. But I mean, it's going to start getting sloppy with the notation, because it's just so hard to write these curly brackets and not screw it up. But you know, typically, curly brackets here means the state of all spins. What does the prime mean? The prime means the set of states in which one spin has changed its sign. So for example, if I imagine that this state S refers to a state like all four spins are up, I have four spins in my system, I'm going to now think about a dynamics where I pick a spin randomly and change its orientation, just one spin at a time. So this state might represent the first three spins up and one spin down. This state might represent these two spins up, one spin down, and another guy up. And so I'm looking now at all possible ways of getting to the state with all four spins up by flipping just a single spin in the system. So already here at the level that I'm about to write, I'm assuming what's so-called single spin flip dynamics. And it's a very simple picture of how you might invent a dynamics. And in fact, in the past maybe 20 years, the biggest advances in numerical simulations of non-equilibrium spin systems is trying to invent cluster dynamics rather than single spin flip dynamics, where you flip many spins at once to try and speed up simulations. But for the point of view of theory, let's just worry about single spin flip dynamics. So again, there's a gain term because we can have a hopping rate from some state S prime. So here is a state where one spin is flipped, and so there's a hopping rate from this state S prime. And in principle, what I should mean here is a particular spin. So I should say that I have to sum over all possible ways where one of the many spins is flipped. And so I should even put like an index I here to denote that the ith spin is flipped. And then if I flip that ith spin, then I'll go to the state curly S. So I sum over all possible ways of flipping one spin, and there will be a rate of flip, which is SI prime, going from the state where the ith spin is flipped to the desired final state, and the probability of being in these neighboring states, and all contributes to the gain. So again, the picture, I think, is much clearer than the equation. I just want to ask, what is the probability of being here, and any nearby states with a rate that I hop to here contributes to the gain term? And similarly, there's a loss term. So I'm going to sum over all states, again, SI prime, where I start in my desired state, and I lose probability of being at the desired state by flipping one spin. And so I'll have this, PST. So this corresponds to the processes where I'm hopping out of the desired state. And I just have to sum over all possible states that happen to be connected to, times the transition rate of going from the desired state to any other state, times the probability of being starting in that particular state. So this thing is called the master equation. Hopefully it looks now semi-familiar to you because we've seen it in aggregation kinetics, we've seen it in random lock problems. And so it's a starting point for describing the evolution of the probability distribution. Now, equilibrium. At this stage, we know nothing about these transition rates. We know nothing. But one thing that we'd like to say is that if we go to equilibrium, that we should recover something which is familiar to us. So let's study equilibrium. So equilibrium means that this thing is equal to zero. It means that the rate of the probability of being in a particular state is prescribed by the Boltzmann factor, so there shouldn't be any flow of probability in or out of any state because everybody is happy in equilibrium. So if I'm in equilibrium, then this tells me that the summation over all S prime, and now I'm going to start being sloppy, so don't keep writing a million indices and a lot of gloppy stuff. I'll just drop the index I here. So I have the transition rate W S prime going to S P S prime T has to equal summation W S going to S prime P S T. So I just equate these two sides of the equation. And again, notice here that I've now been sloppy and I don't write the curly brackets here anymore. I hope it's clear. It's just so it saves a lot of writing to just be a little bit simplistic here.
And that's specifically at the equilibrium?
This is in equilibrium.
Okay.
Yes. So, but what does this mean pictorially? What this means pictorially is that the total flux coming in equals the total flux going out. So that's all this means here. This is the same as total probability flux in equals total probability flux out. And so if we satisfy this condition, then we're guaranteed that we go to equilibrium. Now the problem is that these equations are very difficult to analyze theoretically. And so now comes the detailed balance condition. And so because it appears often, I usually use the abbreviation detailed balance. Detailed balance is a stronger condition, and it's sufficiently strong that it basically constrains the hopping rates completely. The detailed balance condition is not to say that the total flux coming in equals the total flux going out, but what it says is detailed balance is that the flux on each bond is balanced. So again, coming to this picture, I have four places where I can come in and four places where I can go out, and the sum of the incoming currents is equal to the sum of the outgoing currents. Detailed balance says that along every single bond, the flux is conserved. It's a much stronger condition. And again, it's not like there's any principle I'm stating of where it comes from. It just is a very useful guess with which to then develop analytical theories. Yes?
We know from quantum mechanics, Fermi's golden rule, doesn't that tell us that the transition rate in each direction should be equal?
Well, okay, so if you really want to get fundamental about it, then you say, well, why am I not, where's quantum mechanics all this? Where's Fermi's golden rule and all that kind of stuff? And the thing is that, first of all, the calculation of the matrix elements for a real many-body system is basically an impossibility in the framework of quantum mechanics. Also, the other thing is that typically we're interested in temperatures which are very small compared to the transition temperature of a quantum, of a ferromagnetic system, in which case quantum mechanical effects really play no role at all. So you're correct that if you want to be fundamental and try and derive these, you should go to Fermi's golden rule and try and analyze that. And you end up with mathematical intractability. So this simpler rule is enough to say that we can guarantee the correct equilibrium. And if we get the correct equilibrium, then we might think that the time dependence that we put in is somehow universal. And you will see, as I develop some specific examples, that you'll see very quickly there's sort of, I don't know, a certain level of fundamentality of the dynamics that comes out of this. So maybe ask your question again in a half an hour if it still remains. Anyway, so detailed balance is that the flux in each bond is balanced. And so that just says mathematically that W, S prime going to S, P, S prime T, is equal to W, S going to S, W, S going to S prime, P, S, T. So this is the detailed balance condition. This is, yeah, so, well, no. What I'm trying to say is that we have some arbitrary state space, we have some probability distribution, and I'm asking what are the conditions to ensure that I will go to the equilibrium state? And so what we're going to do now is we're going to use this in a situation where we're not at equilibrium. So this rule was determined by the rule. This rule was motivated by trying to ensure that we will go to equilibrium, but I'm going to apply it in a non-equilibrium situation. Okay. So now that we've formulated this rule, let's now try and actually calculate the transition rate of the Ising-Glauber model, and then let's try and solve for some basic observables in the kinetic Ising model. So again, the detailed balance condition is, so let me write it in the following way, and let me keep the same order as in my notes. Yes. So let's compute W, S going to S prime, divided by W, S prime going to S. So just from this equality, this is equal to P, S prime T, divided by P, S T. And again, let me remind you, what do we mean by the terminology S prime? That means it's a state S in which one spin has flipped. So the thing is that now we go to equilibrium. In equilibrium, these probabilities are just given by the Boltzmann factors. And so from the ratio of the Boltzmann factors, we will get the ratio of the rates. The thing is that what we cannot determine by this is the absolute value of the transition rates. We only can determine the ratio of the rates. Now, if I want the absolute value of the transition rates, then I have to go back to fundamental quantum mechanics and do detailed calculations and figure out what the rates are. But if I just want the ratio of the rates, then this is good enough. And as we're going to see, it's the ratio of the rates which are important, and the overall rate doesn't really play any role except determining a natural time scale to the problem. Okay, so anyways, let's now calculate this thing. So let me remind you that for the Ising Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian is minus j, summation over nearest neighbors ij, si, sj. I'm assuming that's familiar to everybody. And here, the summation is over nearest neighbor pairs ij. So I'll write that with an angle bracket. So when I write the Boltzmann factor, here I'm going to get e to the minus beta h. But there's a minus sign here, so this becomes plus beta j summation si sj. And up here, we have the same thing. But since one spin is flipped, and in particular, so for example, if say it's the I spin, which is flipped, so I'll restore the index I just temporarily here, then when one spin is flipped, it's just going to be e to the minus beta j summation si sj. So again, I'm assuming that the I spin has only flipped, and so the only difference between these two factors is the sign associated with si, but since it appears everywhere in the sum, there's a minus sign which comes out of here. So this simple rule now is sufficient to actually determine the ratio of the rates. And then, as you're going to see, I can very easily back out of this the absolute value of the rates up to an overall constant. And once we have these rates, we're going to then study the detailed dynamics of the Ising-Glauber model. Now, to make a little bit further progress here, let me just do some very simple algebra, which relies on some nice features of the spin values here that take on the values plus or minus 1. This is part of the reason that we focus on the Ising model, because A, it's simple, and B, because the algebra of the Ising spin operators, when they're plus or minus 1, makes some very simple, they simplify the algebra of dealing with these objects here. So what I'm going to do now is, let me write this, the numerator, let's write this as cosh minus beta j summation si sj plus sinh. Well, first of all, notice that cosh of a minus is the same as cosh with plus, so let's just rub out the minus sign there. And here we have sinh of a negative argument, but let's forget about the negative here and just put it in front of the sinh. We can certainly do that. So we're going to have sinh beta j summation si sj. And downstairs, I have the same thing. Cosh beta j summation si sj. Then I have plus sinh beta j summation si sj. Let me now divide through by the cosh everywhere. And what I'm going to get is 1 minus hyperbolic tanh beta j summation si sj. And downstairs I have 1 plus hyperbolic tanh beta j si sj summation. So this is the rule for the ratio of the transition rates in the Ising-Glauber model. Yes, question.
Minus is like all the spins are changing sign. But for just a pair change sign, so the minus sign can be factorized out.
Well, no, the thing is that what I mean here by this si prime is just a single spin si has flipped. But in the summation, this is summation over all pairs ij, but since the si appears everywhere inside of the sum, if I flip si, then it's the same as keeping the same object, but just putting a minus sign out in front. I don't think I've answered your question.
That summation is two principles. If I and j are running from 1 to n.
These are only nearest neighbor pairs.
If it's running, if I is just like all different, so they have three, I go 1 to 3, it might be flip, say, the third spin.
Right.
It will affect just the third spin.
Absolutely.
And there you are taking the third, second, and third spin.
Well, I'm sorry. See, the thing is that this transition rate is referring to, so you're correct in what you're saying, but what is not quite correct yet is that this transition rate is a transition rate where I have a state with like 27 spins in some state, and I'm going to flip only spin number 3. So here, this is the Boltzmann factor where the I spin is somebody fixed. So here is spin I, and I'm looking at all the neighbors of spin I. So these are spin j, and j is, so this sum is only over one index, j. I is here fixed. Does that help? OK. All right. Let's see. Yeah, so let's now specialize to the case of one dimension, because it's the simplest case, and we can understand a lot from one dimension. And then we'll see how it goes, whether I'm going to go to higher dimension today or next day. So in one dimension, what I'm going to do is the following. I have the summation Si Sj. But here, what that means of nearest neighbors, that means that j is equal to I minus 1 and j is equal to I plus 1. Those are the nearest neighbors of I. So this is the same as Si Si plus 1 plus Si minus 1. And so now let's look at this transition rate. What we're going to get then is 1 minus hyperbolic tanh. And now let me do the following little trick. 2 beta j, I'm going to multiply by 2, and then I'm going to put 1 half Si, Si minus 1 plus Si plus 1. And that's all inside the hyperbolic tanh. And then I have 1 plus hyperbolic tanh of the same thing again. Like that. Now, the thing is that notice here, what is the possible values of this variable? This variable can take on 3 possible values. If all the s's are 1, then this has the value 2. Actually, let's actually extend this to include all of this stuff. This variable takes 3 possible values. If all the s's are 1s, then this takes a value 1. If si plus 1 and si minus 1 are oppositely oriented, they take on the value 0. And if all the s's are minus 1, this takes on the value minus 1. So this object here is either plus or minus 1 or 0. And now notice the following nice feature, that if I have tanh of epsilon x, where epsilon is equal to 0 plus or minus 1, that's exactly the same as epsilon tanh x. Let's just check. If epsilon is 1, I have tanh x equals tanh x, no problem. If epsilon is 0, then I have tanh 0, which is 0, equals 0. And if epsilon is minus 1, I have tanh of minus x, which is minus tanh x. So with this little device, the whole point of this is I can now pull outside of the hyperbolic tanh, these spin operators, because they take on the value of plus, minus 1, or 0. And the reason why this trick is so helpful is that you see that this is some many-body operator, and it's inside of tanh. You have to like expand it in a power series if you want to deal with it. But if I can pull it out at the very beginning, then I have a much simpler operator. So the thing is that this now becomes 1 minus, and so let me pull out this stuff in front. I'm going to have 1 half si, si plus 1. Let's try and put it in the right order. Si minus 1 plus si plus 1 times hyperbolic tanh of 2 beta j. Because this combination appears so often, I'm going to just write this as gamma, where here gamma is defined to be hyperbolic tanh of 2 beta j. And downstairs, I'll write this as 1 plus gamma over 2 si, si minus 1 plus si plus 1. And now I'm almost done with trying to derive a dynamical rule. So what we have here, this is the ratio of the rates. And now I'm going to make the simplest possible guess, which is that I found the ratio of the rates, and I'm going to just say, WS going to S prime is just exactly this object with some overall normalization constant. And so I just write this as equal to 1 half 1 minus gamma over 2 SI SI minus 1 plus SI plus 1. So this last step is entirely a guess. I know that if I take the ratio of the two rates, I will reproduce this formula. putting the one half in front is entirely a guess, and you'll see why I make that guess momentarily. But again, as Eric's question intimated, if I really wanted to figure out what I should put here, I really have to use quantum mechanics and figure out the true microscopic transition rates, and then I would get a number here. But this number is not going to affect very much in terms of the interesting critical behavior, because it's all buried inside of these spin operators. Now, let's spend a little bit of time to understand what is the meaning of this object here, because it's actually very simple, but it's a little bit buried inside of like some, you know, fancy algebra here, but it actually has a very simple geometric meaning. So let's spend some time dissecting this transition rate and trying to understand what it means. So here's our transition rate. And so it's equal to, so we say W, S going to S prime. So it's equal to 1 half, 1 minus gamma over 2, Si minus 1 plus Si plus 1. So to figure out what it really means, let's just look at a local neighborhood around spin I and figure out what is the transition rate for the various types of configurations that can occur. So let's label here spin I minus 1, spin I plus 1. Let's suppose we start with all three spins up. And we want to ask, what is the transition rate where I take the ith spin and flip it? So again, this WS going to S prime, now to just be pedantic, I'll put an SI here to denote that I'm looking at the transition rate where this spin will flip. So the rate at which this happens, where the central spin flips and the system started off aligned. Well, just think about it intuitively. In this state, the spins are happy. They're all in harmony with each other. They're pointing in the same direction. The Ising model has a ferromagnetic interaction. They all want to spin, point together. So if I make this, which is a higher energy state, so from the equilibrium perspective, there's a probability of having the three spins aligned. And if I make one of them misaligned, I'm going to a higher energy state. So it should be a small probability of making a transition out of this happy state of affairs. And if we look at what is the transition rate, so let me make a little chart here. What is W? So initially, Si, Si minus 1, Si plus 1, they're all equal to 1. So this thing is equal to 2. The 2 cancels, and I'm going to get here 1 half, 1 minus gamma. So that's the transition rate. Let's now look at the state where the two outside spins are anti-aligned, and the middle spin is up. And so now let's ask, what is the transition rate where the middle spin flips? So we're going to go to final state, up, down, down. So in this case, this spin, his left neighbor says point up, his right neighbor says point down, so he's getting equal amounts of cross signals from his two neighbors. This guy, he's friendly with this guy and he's unfriendly with this guy. In the final state, he now becomes friendly with this guy and unfriendly with that guy. So in some sense, not much has changed. He's in the same state of confusion because he's got the same confused environment around him. And if I look what the transition rate is, well, in this case, Si minus 1 and Si plus 1, they add up to 0. So this is 0, and I'll just get a transition rate 1 half. And finally, let's look at the other case where, say, these two outside spins are up and this spin is pointing down. So this is kind of a high energy state because the spins are misaligned. And if the spin flips, it becomes a happier state of affairs because now the spin is aligned with its neighborhood. This should happen with a higher rate. And if we now look at what happens in this rate, if Si minus 1 and Si plus 1 are both minus 1, and Si is plus 1, this whole product here is minus 1, which conspires with this minus sign to make a plus, and I'm going to get 1 half, 1 plus gamma. So we see that transitions that make the spins more in harmony happen at a higher rate than transitions that try and remove the harmony. And so this is a basic, you know, that's the manifestation of the detailed balance condition, that you're trying to have it more likely to go to lower energy states than higher energy states. And in equilibrium, the relative populations in low energy states will be higher than in higher energy states. Let's look at this case. So this is W as a function of gamma. let's now look at the case gamma going to, so I forgot, gamma was equal to hyperbolic tanh of 2 beta j. So the interesting case to consider is the case of zero temperature, which is the same as beta going to infinity. So if I take the limit beta going to infinity, then at infinite beta, the hyperbolic tanh of infinity is 1. So let's look at when gamma is equal to 1. So in this case, we get a transition rate, which is 0. Here, a transition rate of a half, and here, a transition rate of 1. So in the zero temperature limit, these transition rates do something very simple. Energy raising moves never occur. Energy conserving moves occur with probability half. And energy lowering moves occur with the rate 1. So in the framework of doing a simulation of Ising models, this is a very nice picture to have in mind of what's going on, that when I do zero temperature dynamics, so I start with a system at infinite temperature, like the left panel on page 58, and suddenly quench to zero temperature, the only thing that happens is that spins flip to lower the local energy, and this process continues and continues, and the system coarsens and coarsens as a function of time. And the goal now is to understand how this coarsening proceeds as a function of time. OK, any questions with this general formalism? Yes?
When you derive these W, you use the values of P's at equilibrium. You have the ratio of the two.
That's correct.
So are we assuming that the ratio between two transition rates is independent of equilibrium and equilibrium? Or?
Well, the thing is that these transition rates have nothing to say. I mean, I derived the transition rates by trying to force that the correct equilibrium state was reached. But the point is that I'm now going to apply these transition rates for arbitrary initial states. Exactly. It's a purely ad hoc rule. And so that's part of what makes non-equilibrium stat mech so much more open, because there is no overarching formula that says transition rates from God are something. It's like all these rules are ad hoc. OK. So let's now, in the remaining part of this lecture, let me now spend some time actually trying to solve the underlying random walk problem in this state of all spins and try and figure out how does the magnetization evolve as a function of time, how does the order evolve as a function of time in the one-dimensional Ising model. So let's now look at correlation functions. Let me first ask, how many people are familiar with the term correlation functions? More or less everybody. OK, very good. So the thing is that in order to study the evolution of the probability distribution, so let's think about back in the days of the good old random walk. You have some transition rates. One is interested in the probability distribution. You calculate it, and it's, you say, well, I've solved for everything. Similarly here, I have a transition. I have transition probabilities in a state space. And I find the probability density in the state space, I've solved for everything. In this case, though, the probability density is much more complex in its form. And instead of looking at the probability density itself, we're going to look at low-order moments. Just as in the random walk, we looked at things like the mean displacement, the mean square displacement. Here, we're going to do the same kind of thing. So I'm going to look at so-called low-order correlation functions. So let me define Sj, capital Sj, is just the mean value of Si. So little Si is the spin, and this angle bracket here is going to denote the average value averaged over this dynamics. And another thing I'm going to look at is what I'm going to call Sij, which is defined to be the two-spin correlation function, Si, Sj. So this somehow is going to tell us something about the average magnetization. This is going to tell us where two spins, which are separated by some distance, are they aligned or misaligned? And that's going to tell us something about the degree of ordering in the system. So I want to now write down dynamical equations for these quantities. So in principle, the kosher way that you want to calculate, for example, Sj dot, if I want to do this sort of fundamentally, and if you look at any textbook and in Glauber's original paper, this is what he did, you'd say, well, what I have to do is I have to do a summation over all spins, over all states of the system, and then I write Sj dp dt. So this p, again, is a function of all the spins in the system and t. You'd have to do this sum. And again, you can look at any textbook or in Glauber's original paper, and you'll find that this involves, like, you have to be like a tax attorney. You've got to, like, you have to write this all out, and you've got to, like, enumerate all the possibilities, and you've got to do everything right, and it's so easy to make a mistake. And I know that the first time I read Glauber's paper, I spent maybe 3 days scratching my head, and why is there a minus sign, and it disappeared, and what's going on here? It was really complicated. And so I'm going to show you a much simpler way of getting to the same point with dispensing with most of the formal niceties and difficulties. And so the idea here to find the mean value of the spin is to just ask, what happens in a single spin flip event? So let's look at the jth spin and how can it possibly change with time? So I argue, how can the jth spin change with time? If it's sitting here, say, pointing up, how can it change? If I flip a spin over here, this guy doesn't care. The only way it's going to change is if I flip the spin itself. And if I flip a spin, if it starts with spin up, it changes to spin down. The change in the spin is exactly minus twice its value. If it started spin down and it flipped up, so it started with minus 1 and it goes to plus 1, the change in its spin value was minus its spin value. It was plus 2. So what I argue here is that Sj dot is equal to minus 2 mean value W. And now let me bastardize my notation a little bit further. Let me put here an index J to emphasize that I'm looking at a single spin flip where I'm flipping the jth spin. So Wj Sj. So again, the point here is that if I ask what is the mean value, the time rate of change of the mean value of the J spin, I have to first pick the J spin. And when I flip it, it changes by a factor of minus 2. And Wj is the rate at which the spin happens to be fixed. So this thing is called the rate equation. It's telling me the rate of change of the J spin in the system. And it changes with the rate Wj, which is the rate at which the J spin is flipped. And when it does flip, it changes by an amount which is twice its value. Yes?
Why is it an expectation value?
Pardon me?
Why is it an expectation value? Why isn't it not just?
Because this thing is that, OK, so let me maybe be a little bit more pedantic here. This is Sj. Let's start with that. You buy that?
Yes.
And now all I'm doing is now I'm taking the expectation value of the whole thing, because I want just the mean value of the spin. OK. So let's calculate what this is. So this is equal to minus 2. And part of the reason I want to do this calculation is to get you a little familiar with kind of the algebra of these spin operators, because they're very pleasant once you're used to the game. It comes very naturally. Yes, Chris.
We have Sj defined as the expectation value of Si.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's dyslexia. That's nothing more than that. Yes. Okay. Anyway, so Sj. So we have here Sj. And now what is Wj? So let's just write it out. So it's going to be equal to 1/2, 1 minus gamma over 2, Sj times Sj minus 1 plus Sj plus 1. That's what we have to calculate. So first point is, notice that the 1/2 cancels the 2. There's a minus sign, which is out in front. And there's two types of terms that appear here. First of all, there's a minus Sj with a 1. And so we're going to get minus capital Sj. Because when I take the expectation value of little Sj, I just get capital Sj. So on the left-hand side, I have capital Sj dot. So this term gives me a minus Sj. And then I have the other two terms that come with a plus. So let's first of all look at Sj with the first term. So Sj times Sj, Sj squared. The mean square of value, it's the square of a spin value. But Sj itself can either take the value plus 1 or minus 1. So Sj squared is obviously equal to 1 always, since Sj itself was equal to either plus 1 or minus 1. So when I take Sj squared, I get 1. And then I'm left with the minus and the minus give me a plus. And I'm going to have Sj minus 1 times gamma over 2. So I'm going to have gamma over 2, Sj minus 1. And then from this guy, I'm clearly going to get Sj plus 1. So that is the equation for the mean value of the spin. Notice how it looks so much like a random walk. We have the probability being at site j, and there's a rate of leaving site J and a rate of incoming to site J. If gamma was equal to 1, this would be exactly the one-dimensional random walk equation. Because gamma's not quite 1, it's not quite the random walk equation, but nevertheless, the same techniques that we learned in the first lecture of how you solve this equation still hold true, and so we can solve for this master equation. So it turns out that the solution of this equation, Sj of t, is equal to, what is it equal to? I guess it's equal to, okay, so let me now, just to make life simple, let's suppose, let's take the initial condition. So I'll use the terminology IC for the initial condition. Let's take Sj at t equals 0 is equal to 1. So I'm going to have one spin which is pointing up, and everybody else, actually, let me do it the following way. Let's call it delta J0. So in one equation, I encapsulate that the J spin is got a mean is pointing up, and everybody else, there's no net spin. For this initial condition, this type of master equation, again, has this Bessel function solution. And the answer is Sj of t is equal to, it's equal to I0 of 2t e to the minus 2t. Excuse me. Got to get this right. 2 gamma t, and here 2 gamma t. So that's the answer. For what I'm going to do for the rest of this talk and next lecture, I'm going to specialize in the case of t going to 0. It's just simpler. And we'll see that, again, from the central dogma, as long as we're dealing with subcritical dynamics, we get the same generic behavior. So why not do the simplest case, which is going to 0 temperature? So in the 0 temperature limit, we're going to get that Sj of t is equal to I0 of 2t e to the minus 2t. Now, again, some of you may be familiar with this modified Bessel function of order 0. Some of you may not be. But let me try and demystify this by looking at the magnetization, because you don't really care. You don't really need to know what is the value of every single spin in the system. You'd like to know something more general. And one general piece of information is the average magnetization. So let's look at the magnetization. So let me define M, which is equal to summation 1 over N, summation Sj, and this should be capital S. Let me make it as capital as I can make it. So I take the mean value of the spin at each site, add up over all sites, divide by 1 over N. That's the magnetization. Yes?
Can I solve the spun-in temperature one by rescaling the T time parameter?
Yeah, so finite temperature means, since it appears, gamma T appears together, it's just a rescaling of the time. But you'll see there's actually one little, there's something. Let me go back here, because there's one thing which is important with the temperature. So anyways, if I do this, so let's now sum up these equations. So we're going to take these equations here, sum up over all J. So on the left-hand side of the equation, we're going to get nothing more than M dot. I sum up over all J, divide by N, I get M dot. And on the right-hand side, I get, so when I sum this guy up, I get clearly minus the magnetization. And then I have plus gamma over 2. When I sum this guy up, I get the magnetization. Here I get the magnetization again. So I'll get two magnetizations. And so I'm going to get gamma times m. So I get the very trivial equation that m dot is equal to minus 1 minus gamma m. What is the solution to this equation? Oh, I know it's wrong. Because in light of your question, I did something stupid here. There's no gamma here. Anyways, what is the solution to this equation? We get m of t is equal to e to the minus 1 minus gamma t. So what it says is that the magnetization eventually decays to 0. So I start with one spin up, everybody else no net spin. the magnetization starts out at some value, and it decays away to zero. So it says that m goes to zero as time goes to infinity. However, notice that when gamma is equal to 1, which is zero temperature, the magnetization is conserved. So something very weird is going on here, which is that, and I'm sort of out of room, but let me just say that for gamma greater than 1, m decays to 0. I'm sorry, gamma less than 1, which is temperature non-zero. But when gamma is equal to 1, which is zero temperature, then m is conserved. So the thing is that for the one-dimensional Ising model, since the critical temperature is zero, subcritical dynamics is also zero temperature. So the interesting limit to consider is gamma equals 1, where the magnetization is conserved. So in fact, we learn nothing from all this stuff, because all we've learned is that the magnetization is conserved. So if I start with some magnetization, it stays the same value. How can we characterize this coarsening pattern if I just tell you, well, the initial magnetization is 3/8 and it stays 3/8? We learn nothing by looking at the magnetization. So to understand this coarsening pattern, we have to actually focus on the two-spin correlation function. This will tell us something about the spread of correlations in the system and will actually unravel this picture that we see in front of us of this coarsening pattern. So maybe that I should start that next time, because it's now 2:13. No, my watch says 2:11. Let me just give me maybe 5 minutes. I will not do anything fancy. I'm not going to derive this, but let me just spend a little bit of time talking about the correlation function, because it'll be helpful to have this in your mind for thinking for next time. So let's now just focus attention on the correlation function. So let me define Sij, which is Sisj. What is this object? And in particular, let's do something even simpler. Let's look at Si plus 1, which is the mean value of Si plus 1. What is the physical meaning of this object? And what I want to show you is that there's a very nice connection between this correlation function and something known as domain walls. These domain walls essentially play the role of the elementary excitations in the system. And you may know from, say, like, let's think about Fermi gases at zero temperature, like the electron gas. At zero temperature, there's a Fermi C, which is perfectly filled. And at the very top of the Fermi C, you can promote an electron from from below the Fermi C to just above. And those electron hole pairs are the elementary excitations in the system. And one can understand many basic properties of solid-state physics by just focusing on those few electrons which are the very top of the Fermi C. So similarly here, there is a simple geometric viewpoint that can relate the spin correlation function to domain walls. And once you see that there's a connection with domain walls, there's a very simple geometrical way of thinking about the kinetic Ising model. So let me write this in the following way. This is equal to plus 1 times the probability that two nearest neighbor spins are aligned. Because again, these two spins, Si and S plus 1, Si and Si plus 1, they can either both be aligned or they could be misaligned. Those are the only two outcomes. If they're both aligned, then the value of this is equal to 1. And that happens with the probability equal to the probability that they're aligned. And then it's equal to plus minus 1, the probability that the two spins are anti-aligned. So that is what the correlation function is algebraically. Now let me try and represent it geometrically. So if I have like a system of spins like this, and here's spin I, and here's spin I plus 1, if the spins are misaligned at this point, I'm going to assign, so where the spins are misaligned, there's like some extra energy floating around. I'm going to assign a little thing here called a domain wall particle that is wherever there are two spins which are misaligned. So whenever two spins are misaligned, there'll be a particle. And whenever two spins are aligned, there's nothing at all. So I can rewrite this thing as plus 1 times the probability that there's nothing. There's no domain wall particle. And so the probability that there's nothing, I'll write as 1 minus the density of domain wall particles. And here I have plus minus 1 times the probability that the two spins are anti-aligned, which means that there is a domain wall particle between the two spins. The probability that there's a domain wall particle is just the density of domain wall particles. So from this, I get something really trivial but important, 1 minus 2 rho. So there's a one-to-one connection between the density of domain wall particles and the nearest neighbor correlation function. This connection, Si plus 1, or alternatively, I can write that rho is equal to 1 half 1 minus Si, I plus 1. This simple connection is extremely useful in understanding what happens for coarsening patterns, because when there's lots of domain wall particles, then the spins are typically not very well aligned. And when there's very few domain wall particles, then we know that we have large domains that are all aligned with very rare intervening domain walls between them. So the density of domain walls, which is quantified by the time dependence of the correlation function, will be crucial in understanding the birth of order as a function of time. So that's where I'll begin with tomorrow's lecture. So any questions? Yes.
Is there do we make a distinction between domain wall going from left to right, like the spin up to spin down?
Well, if I'm dealing with zero magnetic field, then the system is spin up, spin down, symmetric, and then there is no distinction. If, however, there was a magnetic field, then domain walls going to the right would be different than domain walls to the left. Yes, that's a good point. Yes?
If you do a higher dimension, do you have domain wall particles, or are they like surface things?
Well, the thing is that in higher dimension, you can still think about domain wall particles, but they're now part of let's talk about two-dimensional case, because that's simpler to think about. Then, if I have, say, for example, a single downspin, which is surrounded by all up, then I have like four domain particles in a little cluster like this. And when a single spin flips, there'll be, you create like multiple domain walls or kill multiple domain walls. So in higher dimension, it doesn't have quite the same utility as in one dimension, where like there's a really one-to-one connection between spin flip and domain walls. But nevertheless, the density of domain walls is telling me how much excess energy is living in the system. And so the evolution of the density is still useful for deciding how ordering is developing. Yes?
Here, rho is a global variable, which is density of domain walls.
Right.
And your Si plus 1 is local, like your height.
Right. Well, so, but you see, the thing is that here, this was, first of all, this is an average over all realizations of the dynamics. And if the system is homogeneous spatially, so if I'm assuming that all of my interactions are the same at every single site, then this thing actually does not depend on I and I plus 1. It just depends on the difference. So this thing, for a translationally invariant system, is just a function of the separation and not a function of the endpoints. So in that case, this domain wall then doesn't depend on location. So I was a little bit cavalier here, but the correct statement here is that for translationally invariant systems, this thing, which is a function of I and I plus 1, turns out to be only a function of their difference. And in this case, the difference is 1. It didn't matter what was 1,000 and 1,001, or 11 and 12, or a million and a million plus 1. And so that's, yes, I'm always assuming translational invariant system, uniform interactions. If you have translationally non-invariant systems, like a disordered system, then that's another whole story, because the role of disorder on Ising models is a very rich problem. And for its equilibrium properties, a lot is understood, but the non-equilibrium properties are still quite open and not so well understood. Anything else? I'm done, I guess.